Tuesday.
Monday.
Or Monday. Oh, my goodness. Monday, June 30th, the final day of June. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. I forgot we have Monday. We're Monday through Thursday, not Tuesday through Thursday. Oh, my goodness.
I'm Kevin McCory in for Avi Wolfman Arendt. Today on the show, we're unpacking the big Supreme Court decisions that came down on Friday. The court said that universal injunctions that the lower courts have been using to put a check on the presidency are unconstitutional. So what's going to happen next? If a president signs an executive order that's patently illegal, how's that going to play out? We have a great local law professor in this hour to help us understand the impact of that ruling, plus the state of birthright citizenship, other decisions, including one that allows parents to opt their kids out of public school coursework on religious grounds. Lots to unpack this hour, Cherry.
Yes.
And we want to hear from our audience, of course. Give us a call. What are your thoughts on these recent Supreme Court rulings? Call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
Yeah, and what's so interesting about these cases, because Friday was D-Day, decision day, is that the most impactful cases came down along ideological lines, 6-3. Mm-hmm. Six conservative justices all lined up, and the three liberal justices dissenting powerfully. So we'll also look at those dissents. We'll look at, you know, what this all means. And we hope that you join the conversation. And I'll say this because our listeners are so good at adding context to the conversation. And so 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, leave it on the chat. So we have our trio of news stories.
That's right.
And I was pretty excited.
Number one, big breaking news today.
Breaking news. Philadelphia has been awarded a WNBA franchise. Woo, woo, woo. The league made the announcement today alongside Harris Blitzer Sports and Entertainment, which owns the Sixers. The Philly WNBA team is set to launch its first season in 2030. That's just 5 years from now. The league also announced today that Cleveland will get a team. Their first season will be in 2028. Detroit also gets one with its first season in 2029. All of this is part of a rapid expansion to get the league up to 18 teams. Right now, they have 14. Golden State Valkyries came online this year. Next year, Portland's team will come online. They don't yet have a name. But the WNBA and the NBA Board of Governors still needs to approve all of this. But bottom line, Philly is going to have a WNBA team. My dream has come true.
You know what? I got to confess, I have not been a WNBA viewer. I'm not much of an NBA viewer. I was when the Sixers were better.
It's
I'm a little
okay.
bit of a bandwagon there. But it is very exciting. This is like the first new pro sports team that Philly's going to have since the Union came on board, the MLS team. And there's been a lot of groundswell of support for this happening in the past few years. WNBA has like skyrocketed in terms of popularity. And now Philly's getting in on the action. We have a great legacy of women's sports and women's basketball, especially in the city of Philadelphia. So this is exciting.
Yeah, we used to have a team back in the 90s. It kind of folded. We had a professional women's team and it folded. But this is our chance, really, to make our mark. And by the way, the WNBA commissioner, Kathy Engelhardt, said that the league is confident that Philly will be a powerhouse, both on the court and in the community. And if you're wondering where they're going to play, they'll likely play in the new sports complex arena in South Philly, where the Sixers and Flyers will also play. And that is scheduled to be completed by 2031. But managing partner of the Sixers, Josh Harris, says they hope to move up the timeline so that Philly's WNBA team could play its inaugural season in there. And so we don't know what the name was going to be. All that kind of stuff is fun. But
I'm sure that they're going to maybe open up ideas for what the name could be,
I know.
What the colors could be. That's kind of an exciting part of this.
And who the
well.
Coaches could be. Yeah. Just so many things.
Story number two. Okay, we've got a big situation looming in the city of Philadelphia. The union that represents blue-collar workers is threatening a strike, and there's a deadline looming tonight at midnight. City of Philadelphia's contract with DC-33 expires tonight. The union represents the streets department, the sanitation department, the water department, the police dispatch, licenses and inspections. So this is a big deal.
Like it is.
All the city workers on the blue-collar side are seeking an 8% annual salary increase, while Mayor Sherelle Parker is saying 12% over 4 years. Parker was on social media over the weekend. Let's hear a clip of what she had to say about this unfolding contract drama.
My administration is working with District Council 33 in an effort to achieve what is essential and necessary. But no mayor, not one, has ever proposed wage increases over one term as large as I am proposing.
So the two sides remain far apart, as we were saying right there. The last time we actually had a strike, Cherry, I don't remember this. It was 40 years ago, and it lasted 20 days, and it created a situation where tons of garbage was piling up at city dump sites. So, you know, the trash was not being collected, and I think it became essentially like you could bring your trash to a spot and just, like, throw it on the heap. So really hoping that doesn't happen this time around.
Yeah, because it's summertime and that's going to be a funky situation.
And we have obviously big things happening in the summer in the city, especially 4th of July festivities this week. So if trash starts piling up, it's a nightmare situation. And I guess we'll see how the two sides can find some common ground.
And people are probably wondering, 8% a year for the next 4 years is what DC33 wants.
Right.
That's huge raise. And what they've said is that, look, we know we're not going to get rich working for the city, but our workers cannot afford the cost of living. They can't even afford rents. So they just want to be able to afford to live. That's their argument. But of course, that is a far 8% every year for 4 years versus 12% over 4 years. That's a huge cavern that they have to close. So we'll see what happens. Everybody will be watching this. And we can't forget that the mayor says cleanest, greenest as her main initiatives. And DC33 is a critical part of her priorities. And so they got to close that gap. And they only have a few hours to do that.
Yeah. Story number three, Cherry. Yes. Another big bit of breaking news.
Yeah, a bit of breaking news. Today was a big Monday. Pennsylvania Congressman Dwight Evans announced today that after 45 years in politics, he will be retiring from Congress. He says he will serve out his term, but will not seek reelection in 2026. And so this has opened the question of who will run in 2026 to take his seat in 2027. And by the way, if you don't know who Congressman Evan is, he's 71 years old. Last year, he suffered a stroke, but he has served many, many years as a state rep in West Oak Lane. He was Democratic chair of the House Appropriations Committee for 20 years, did a lot to revitalize Northwest Philadelphia, and is very beloved by that community. He took former Congressman Shaka Fatah's seat and has served since 2016. And so now, you know, there are folks who are popping up and very likely to run for his seat. So it's probably going to be a very crowded race for this congressional seat, which represents large swaths of Philadelphia. Already, folks who have expressed interest include State Senator Sharice Street, who is the State Democratic Party Chair, State Representative Morgan Cephas, who represents West Philly, as well as State Representative Chris Rabb, who represents Mount Airy and West Oak Lane.
Yeah, just to say a little bit more about Dwight Evans, he was a very powerful person in the State House for a long time, really a champion of school choice issues, especially in Harrisburg. He was kind of fundamental in the charter school law. He was an aggressive advocate for school choice expansion in Philly. He gained, you know, followers and detractors based on that. He was also somebody who, you know, from a reporter's standpoint, he was always willing to jump on the phone and
explain his
thinking to you, which, you know, I found very valuable as a person covering the school district for several years. If you had an issue or you had a question for Dwight, he was ready to talk to you. So I always appreciate that about him.
Yeah. And I can't, you know, we can't forget West Oak Lane Jazz Festival was a pretty big deal in his district. It helped revitalize a whole section of that community and was used as a model by a lot of other state reps who brought in music and things like that. And so 45-year career, he says he's fully capable of completing his term and that he's deeply proud of what he has done. And so, we'll be watching that politically.
All right, well, we're going to go to a break here for just a few moments, Cherry. But remember, the main conversation today is about these big Supreme Court rulings. We want your thoughts on those. Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Friday was decision day for the U.S. Supreme Court. The High Court's conservative supermajority handed down several major rulings. the most impactful of which reflect deep ideological divides on the bench.
From birthright citizenship potentially being gutted in 28 states to parents now allowed to pull kids from LGBTQ-themed lessons, the court's decisions raise new questions about who holds power: parents, presidents, judges, voters. To help us unpack the impact of the court's recent decisions, we have David Cohen, professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, with us in studio. David, welcome to Studio 2. It's good to have you back.
Thank you for having me back again.
So, David, I'm just curious. If we look at this big decision on the universal injunctions, this has been a way that the lower federal courts have put a check on presidential power. And the majority in this case seem to be arguing like they were overreaching. Do you see this as a check on the judiciary that was appropriate, or what?
I don't think it was an appropriate decision, but the Supreme Court certainly disagrees with me. They held 6-3 that lower courts cannot issue these universal injunctions against presidential action, even if the presidential action, like in this case, is completely at odds with the Constitution. All the lower courts can do is issue relief to the plaintiffs in that case. So the people who actually had the resources, the time, the energy to bring the case, they can get relief, but anyone else has to do the same thing, with a few exceptions. And so I think that's a real problem, because the president gets to basically do what the president wants, except for the actual plaintiffs in court.
Yeah, I want to talk, because this has a very broad reach, far beyond birthright citizenship, which, by the way, the court did not actually rule on whether or not they did touch that particular issue. And so I want to play this clip with from President Donald Trump, who called the limiting of nationwide injunctions a big win on Friday. He called it a big one. And during a White House press conference, he listed the agenda he'll now move forward with as a result of the court's ruling. Take a listen to what he had to say.
And some of the cases we're talking about would be ending birthright citizenship, which now comes to the fore, ending sanctuary city funding, suspending refugee resettlement, freezing unnecessary funding, stopping federal taxpayers from paying for transgender surgeries, and numerous other priorities of the American people.
And so this ruling drastically limits universal injunctions. It makes it harder, as you said, David, for, you know, judges to stop him. Tell me about the ripple effect. And before we even talk about birthright citizenship, talk about the ripple effect of this ruling and how it can be applied across many, many cases.
Yeah, so right now there's dozens of these injunctions in lower courts against the policies that the president was just talking about, because he's been acting in a way that goes beyond law in a lot of different manners. And the lower courts have said you can't do that. And in saying you can't do that, they have said we're going to stop you until a final ruling on the case, whether it gets to the Supreme Court, but we're going to stop you for now. But with the Supreme Court decision on Friday, he now has carte blanche to go forward with a lot of these policies. And so it's not just birthright citizenship, it's the list that he mentioned. And I think the sort of one of the really big questions following Friday's decision is whether, you know, a few years down the line, if we have a Democratic president, will the court apply the same thing in those circumstances? Because the Supreme Court, when President Biden was president, was happy to bless universal injunctions against his policies, environmental policies, reproductive health policies, school student loan, forgiveness. They didn't seem concerned about universal injunctions in those cases. So now with this new ruling, will they in the future, if it's a Democratic president, or is this really just we're going to let Republican presidents do what they want?
I guess you would think that this is setting precedent on the issue of universal injunctions, and in theory, that should hold no matter who's president. You seem skeptical about
that. Absolutely, right? So we like to think that law is neutral. It doesn't matter who the president is. This is about the presidency. And we know the presidency has been held by many people of different parties, right? But it's hard to look at some of the decisions from the court in liberal policies as opposed to conservative policies and think the court is really doing that. Are they going to find loopholes? Mm-hmm. So they'll say, yes, this decision, Trump versus Casa, yes, this applies. It's still good law. We still believe in it. But here's a loophole where the future Democratic president, yes, this universal injunction will be allowed. That's, I think, a lot of people are fearful of
and
that.
And let's talk about those loopholes, because Justice Amy Coney Barrett, and we're going to bring in a caller in just a moment, but Justice Amy Coney Barrett left two openings for plaintiffs to be able to seek redress from the court on a national basis. One is using class actions, and the other is really arguing and proving that to not do so would have irreparable harm to those plaintiffs. Can you explain, are those easy avenues to pursue?
So there's two main ones she talked about, right? The class action one you just mentioned, right?
Mm-hmm.
So individual plaintiffs bring the case, but they say they're bringing this case on behalf of everyone similarly situated. That's what a class action is. And all those other people don't have to actually come into court. The problem is the Supreme Court over the past couple decades has limited class actions, right? So this is a court that is not friendly to plaintiffs. And so they've made it really hard to bring a class action. So yes, the class action route is available. And there have been two new lawsuits filed since Friday. One that's expanding on the lawsuit that's currently in court, saying, well, let's make it a class action. And one completely brand new case raising a class action claim. So people are trying this. Don't get me wrong. It's just the hurdles are high because of this Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. The second one, it's really when states bring a case.
Mm-hmm.
So when states bring a case and say that in order for us to get complete relief, we need to have a universal injunction. Because right now there are 22 states that have injunctions against the birthright citizenship applying in those states. Not Pennsylvania, New York, Delaware, New Jersey, Maryland. They are part of those 22 states. So the birthright citizenship will not go into effect in those four states along with the other 18. And the theory there is that in order for those states to get full relief, it has to apply in the entirety of the state. But they are going to argue that actually what we really need is for this to apply everywhere. Because if you're born, say, in New Jersey, right,
mm-hmm.
you may then travel to Pennsylvania.
And that's part of your right
yep,
in America.
It's your right to travel to Pennsylvania. And when you're in Pennsylvania, you need to be treated like a citizen that you are in New Jersey. So they are going to go back into court saying, yes, we have injunctions in these 22 states, but in order to get complete relief, that injunction needs to be nationwide. So there's going to be a lot more litigation on this issue.
I'd like to quote Sonia Sotomayor in the dissent here. She writes, "Today the threat is to birthright citizenship. Tomorrow a different administration may try to seize firearms from law-abiding citizens or prevent people of certain faiths from gathering to worship. The court's decision is nothing less than an open invitation for the government to bypass the Constitution." So if I'm a deep conservative, aren't I looking at this fearful of the things that I hold most dear being threatened potentially in the future? And if we have conservative listeners, I would love for you to call in and get your take on that. But what's your take?
Well, I think there's a couple things. In theory, yes. But I think that so far we have not seen Democratic presidents trying to go beyond the law in such clear ways as this administration. So the idea, the quote you raised, the idea that the Democratic administration is going to broadly seize firearms from every citizen or restrict certain faiths from gathering to worship, right? I don't see that happening. But on the other, and the other part of it is that, like I said before, I think the conservatives would feel that this Supreme Court would find a way. Right. That this Supreme Court would find some loophole to say, and actually, in those cases, you can have a universal injunction.
And by the way, I want to invite our listeners, as Kevin just said, to join the conversation. Our question of the day is pretty simple. What are your thoughts on these recent Supreme Court rulings? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, hello. Keep those comments coming in the chat. And I want to bring in a caller, Luann from Glenside, who wants to talk about this whole party division within the court. Luann, you're on Studio 2. What are your thoughts about these recent decisions?
Well, hello, Cherry. Thanks hello. For having me. And, you know, when in your introduction, you talked about these cases being decided along an ideological split. And I think it's really important to understand that just as the law is full of so much nuance, that it is the entire discussion, the entire conversation that's happening nationally is much more nuanced than just simply an ideological divide. For instance, the Scrimeti case. There were many, many institutions and organizations who filed amicus briefs supporting Scrimeti, because, you know, gender is a much more nuanced subject than people and the media present. And for instance, there are many.
That was the gender-affirming care case, right?
Yes, and our comments today were referring to the cases specifically on Friday,
by the way. I understand, but, you know, well, yes, I know. But, I mean, just because there's a whole slew of cases that have come out. And, you know, there are many, many, a large number of Democrats who support the Scrimeti decision. There's an organization called DIAG, D-I-A-G-A, that is Democrats-informed about gender and the nuance and the complicated areas of this you know, and so that it's really not a, there are so much more than to say there's a strict ideological divide.
And in some ways, I agree with you, Luann. And just so just to be clear, and thank you. That's Luann from Glenside on the line, pointing out something very important. And just to be specific, we were talking about the main, the biggest cases that came out Friday, and not making a broader conversation about the entire term. There.
And there was a case that came out Friday that we talked about related to the Affordable Care Act, which it was a 6-3 decision, which included conservatives and
joining with Democrats. Exactly.
Though, you know, I think the caller is absolutely right, right? The no justice is perfectly along any ideological lines, although there are some more than others. But on these really hot button issues, right, it is not a coincidence that this court, which has dominated 6 Republican appointees, 3 Democratic appointees, is aligning itself with the party platform of the Republican Party, right? And yes, there are dissenters within the Republican Party, there are dissenters within the Democratic Party, but it is in alignment. It is finding that the Constitution and the law are consistent with the Republican Party platform, not the Democratic Party platform.
And so, David, I want to ask you about just the what is going to happen. As far as birthright right citizenship, because the reality is that the court did not rule on this. You have 3 courts that have ruled. And so there are sections of the country where birthright citizenship is still legal and is the law of the land. But then there are 28 states right now that at least temporarily, once this ruling goes into effect, may not. So what will this look like if you have part of the country where it's birthright citizenship is a thing, is real, and other parts that aren't?
Well, so it's important to understand, right? Even though the Supreme Court decried universal injunctions, it issued its own universal injunction in a way because it said that this decision doesn't take effect for 30 days. So the president is barred from enforcing the executive order for 30 days. So that's 30 days from this past Friday. In those 30 days, we are going to see a lot of action. I wouldn't be surprised if this case gets back before the Supreme Court sometime in that window of 30 days, because the 2 new class actions that I mentioned, there are going to be states that are going to go back into court and say, we have to have a universal injunction because in order to get complete relief for our citizens. And so there's going to be a lot more litigation. And look, if this executive order does go into effect, right, if this litigation does not result in it being stopped sometime in the next 30 days, it's going to be chaos. There are going to be people traveling across state lines who don't know what their citizenship status is. There are going to be people who are born in one state, not a citizen, but then now they go to another state, they are a citizen, or vice versa. It's going to be a recipe for chaos. And this is exactly why we have the 14th Amendment, to avoid that.
And I wonder also, are the courts prepared for this, you know, increased amount of litigation? Because the Supreme Court only takes a certain number of cases every year. And now they're saying they're the only ones that can really make nationwide decisions. And so I'm just thinking, there's not going to be more justices. Are they going to hire more staff? Like, how are they going to deal with this influx of lawsuits?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the effects of this case. It says basically you need to have a lot more lawsuits. So it's the district court judges who are going to be overwhelmed. They're going to get hundreds upon hundreds a week, probably, of these cases. And that's just a small portion of the people who are affected by this, but now they all have to go to court.
But you do see a path where potentially the Supreme Court would have to rule on the merits of birthright citizenship.
Yes, I think eventually. I mean, in this case, they basically have said, this is not a final decision in this individual case, because the plaintiffs still have an injunction with respect to themselves. That was a preliminary injunction, which means you still have to litigate the case to a final resolution. That will get appealed. eventually to the Supreme Court. So there are, yes, the Supreme Court is going to address this issue sooner or later, probably sooner.
Wouldn't a lower court have to reject, essentially rule that birthright citizenship is illegal for then there to be an appeal to the Supreme Court? And that's what I guess some liberals say is like the gamesmanship that's happening here is because everybody knows it is the law of the land.
Yeah, I mean, every court that has addressed the merits has said that his executive order is unconstitutional. There's only just a few squeaky wheels among the academics who say that otherwise, but otherwise everyone agrees it's unconstitutional. So that's going to continue to happen in these individual cases, maybe a class action too. And the Trump administration will appeal it. It'll get to the Supreme Court probably sooner than later.
And I know we got to move on in just a moment, but I got to ask you, I mean, there's a lot of people who don't have the wherewithal to sue.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just think about, you know, having been involved in a lot of lawsuits earlier in my career, I just wonder, like, how is this going to impact regular people and who are having their, you know, who may be impacted by something like this, who live in a state that's not going to sue. Like, what's going to happen to regular folks if they don't have the means to participate in the legal process?
I mean, this was the benefit of universal injunctions, is to avoid telling every single person that a law affects, you have to find your own lawyer and get your own time to go into court. That's what universal injunctions avoid happening, the necessity of happening. Now, people who don't have the time or resources, they're going to be left out in the cold unless the class action or state relief winds up working.
Well, it's going to be busy.
Yeah,
busy.
Let's pivot to one of the other decisions that came out where the conservative majority basically sided with a group of parents who were saying that they should have the right to opt out of certain coursework in Maryland. That was the school district that this case was based in, where LGBTQ themes were being discussed and presented. And the Supreme Court agreed with them. They said, yes, the school district does need to allow you that opportunity to opt out. Now you have the dissent on the liberal wing of the bench saying that this is going to have drastic ripple effects for public education and, you know, just could be logistically like mind-numbing the amount of things that you might have to deal with. How do you see this case?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think the dissent has the better argument here. The idea that parents get to opt out of these, look, these were five books that were in a shelf of a lot of books that K through five students could read that teachers may want to introduce as part of general reading as opposed to just make available to some students to read. And now parents get to say, I don't want my student being a part of that because of religious objections. That opens up the door for all sorts of religious objections, right? So maybe you've got religions who think that women shouldn't be working. Yeah. And you've got, you know, a woman who is a book about a woman who's working in business. And I don't want my student reading that. That goes against my faith. Mm-hmm. Now you've got, and then you've got liberal religions who disagree with abstinence only or may disagree with capitalism, right? Basically, you can find people who have religious objections to a lot of different things. And now school districts are going to have to accommodate those students who say, I don't want to be a part of that. That's chaos.
And when you imagine this, like logistically, what does that mean?
Right.
Like,
do they go to the gym? Do they go to the lunchroom? Where do they go? Who supervises them? What do they do in the meantime? This is why Maryland, the district in Maryland, they originally had an opt-out policy, mm-hmm. but they said it didn't work for all these reasons.
And I want to throw this because in her dissent, Justice Sotomayor warned that the court is turning away from multiculturalism. And I want to, do we risk sort of public schools becoming less public because everybody's not really part of the learning?
Yeah. And so, look, to be fair to the majority opinion, I think they really think that they are furthering multiculturalism because they are saying, look, we have people of all different faiths and we want to respect those faiths and respect the children of those faiths. But I think Justice Sotomayor in dissent has the better argument saying, look, books touch on all sorts of different topics. They show all different families. They show all different lifestyles. They show all different ways of being good in the world. And students need to be exposed to that and see that and see that, look, this is a book about two men who got married and the family that celebrates them. And that's something children should see and appreciate and realize there are other people in who walk in the world that are different than them and think that that's, you know, it may not be consistent with your religion, but at least treat these people with respect and kindness. And so she was saying this is just about kindness, and the Supreme Court saying you can opt out of that.
So to quote from Samuel Alito's decision here, public education, he says, is a public benefit, and the government cannot condition its availability on parents' willingness to accept a burden on their religious exercise. He goes on to say that the logistical concerns are overstated. The board goes to great lengths to provide independent parallel programming for other students, such as those who qualify for multilingual learner programs and those who qualify for individualized education programs. So he's saying, look, the school district is already differentiating. This is just one more way they have to do it. And to not provide that would be to put too much of a burden on the religious liberty of that family.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he doesn't think this is that big a deal. He says there are opt-outs for other parts of the schooling process. And so this is just another one. I mean, look, the educators, and he's not an educator, the educators on the ground in this is one of the most diverse counties mm-hmm. in the country. Religious, race, ethnicity. And they tried it, and they said, this does not work. It is not consistent with how we run a school. And, you know, these six non-educators, the justices, said, you know, actually, you can make it work. So, you know, this is one of those, who knows better, the six justices or the school board that's actually tried to make it work.
My big question with this is, where is the line? You know, because people can be in any kind of religion, and they could say that their religion says, fill in the blank. And I just could see it getting down this slippery slope where, you know, civil rights,
yeah,
for example.
Interracial marriage.
You start adding some different things that bump up against race, bump up against gender. And so who is going to be the decider here? Does the court? I feel like the court hasn't provided any real guidance on that question.
And they never do. They stay out of the business of saying this is a correct or incorrect interpretation of your religion. And that's across all religious cases. They never want to be in the business of saying you are interpreting your religious texts or principles correctly or incorrectly. So that does open the door for exactly what you're saying, which is that someone says, well, in my religion, black and white people should never be married, right? So now the books that have interracial marriages, they can be opted out of. In my religion, women shouldn't be in the workplace. Now, whether that's a correct interpretation of the religion, majority interpretation of religion, is irrelevant. The court's going to say, okay, that's your interpretation. You get to opt out.
And then there's, we were talking about this, Kevin and I, evolution.
Yep.
You could talk about yoga,
mm-hmm.
you know, Eastern principles or whatever. I mean, there's so many things that you could start saying folks want to opt out of.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is what I think the school district said. We just can't do this. We can't make it work.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. Our question is pretty simple today. What are your thoughts on these recent Supreme Court rulings? The number, again, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave those comments in the chat. I'm going to read this email from Ruth, who says, in one case, the court tells parents they have no right to decide on the health care for their trans children, while in another case, they say parents have a say in the public school curricula their children will experience due to religion. That makes no sense. And Ruth is part of a group of folks who just cannot, reconcile the Scrimeti decision with this decision about opting out in school lessons.
Yeah, I think Ruth has a really, really good point here. And it's important to understand with the Scrimeti case, the gender affirming care case, the court said it was constitutional under one theory, equality. That case is still going to continue on under other theories. So this theory that Ruth raised, that parents get to control the medical care of their kids, that is still going to be litigated in this case. So the Scrimeti case isn't over. Just, you know, most cases that go to the Supreme Court don't end in the Supreme Court. There's mm-hmm. still things that happen in the lower courts. And so this exact argument will be raised in the lower courts that parents get to control the medical care of their children. And we'll see what happens when that works its way up to the top. And will the court have this inconsistency that Ruth is pointing out, that religious parents get to opt out of LGBTQ+ instruction, but LGBTQ+ supportive parents don't get to control the upbringing of their children? Are they going to go that route? That would seem quite hypocritical to me.
Yeah, interesting.
Yes, I guess I'm curious what you make of, we referenced earlier, the Affordable Care Act case, where you had conservatives joining the liberals, essentially saying that access to these preventative care measures are in fact constitutional. So I know you're pretty skeptical of the partisan nature of the court. You just see this decision kind of as a little bit of a bone to throw towards the idea that there is still integrity in the court?
Look, I don't think that's why the conservatives crossed over. So look, this was the three Democratic appointed justices, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. They are joined by three of the six Republican appointees, Roberts, Barrett, and Kavanaugh, to say that the Affordable Care Act's preventive care requirements, including that things like PrEP to treat HIV, that they have to be covered under insurance plans. And the Supreme Court said that that is okay. This was a complicated question about the structure of administrative agencies and who gets to appoint them and when the president has to. So it was really sort of the actual merits were sort of, the issues around HIV and PrEP and preventive care were in the background of this case. But yes, those three did cross over and join the liberals. That happens. That does happen. And why? You know, the three that I just mentioned, they are very conservative. They're not as conservative as Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito. Those three are very conservative. They almost never vote inconsistent with the Republican Party platform. But the three I just mentioned do cross over. And in this one, they did. And, you know, I don't know why. The law on this issue is very convincing to them. Or they see that this affects millions and millions of people and they don't want to disrupt that. I don't know.
I guess some could see that as evidence that this court is not just so baldly political as it seems like you're making them.
It's not as clear as ruling
on the merits.
Every single case,
and
but it's most.
I want to bring up I don't necessarily agree with that point of view, because I wonder if you flip it, because you currently have a Republican leading the Department of Health and Human Services. And could that lead to, does that open the door for politically motivated changes to Obamacare now that, you know, this court in that way has made this decision? I just wonder if you flip it, how that works.
There's two things on your point. One, they did reiterate that the Secretary of the Health and Human Services, which is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., right, has the authority to remove all of these people at will. So if he's unhappy with these recommendations and wants them changed, he can put in place people who will have the recommendations he wants. So in issuing this ruling, upholding the Affordable Care Act's preventive care requirements, the court did reiterate, well, Bobby Kennedy can change all that. Mm-hmm. So that's one. Two, in this case, there was a separate claim from this employer saying, I'm a religious employer, you know, sort of along the books case we were just talking about, saying I'm a religious employer and I don't want to cover HIV PrEP medicine. And the lower courts said, well, actually, okay, you can opt out of that because of your religion. And that was not at issue in this case. So maybe these three conservatives were comfortable with the fact that this employer was already allowed to opt out of what it didn't want to because of its religion.
And so you had a situation where employers who have religious objections could opt out. And also there is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in office, who can make changes and remove PrEP. And so the impact wouldn't be as sweeping as possible. And that's what I was thinking about this. I do want to pivot and make sure that we talk about the case Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. And let me just explain it quickly. The court upheld a Texas law requiring porn sites to verify users over age 18 using ID, credit card, or biometric data. And the justices said protecting minors justifies this burden. And dissenters warned it threatens privacy. I want your take on this decision. I know it's limited right now to just that Texas law, but it could have reverberating effects.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Supreme Court, this was an opinion written by Justice Thomas, another split Republican appointees versus Democratic appointees, 6-3. And they really, you know, just said it doesn't matter what the free speech rights are of adults. They can be burdened in order to protect children.
Yeah.
And that Texas thinks it's protecting children with this age verification system. And so they can do that. Now, if California thinks it's protecting children by having age verification requirements to go on, say, the NRA website or a gun purchasing website, Maybe now California can do that. It's really saying, you know, and we've known this for a long time, minors have less constitutional rights. And in making sure that minors are restricted, we can impact adults too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just curious, like, has this ever been fought out over, like, movie ratings? Like, you know, if I'm 15 and I go to see a rated R movie and they say you can't, is there somebody who's willing to take up my free speech case?
No, because that's private industry. And so this only applies to the government. Now, if Texas were to pass a law saying that movies have to do that, that would be different. But this is government requirement on these private sites. These private sites don't want that because they want the, you know, freest interactions possible. But this is Texas requiring this. So I think we're going to see this proliferate in a lot of states. And we may see it in other areas where there has to become age verification in order to get onto the internet for certain sites.
And by the way, and we do have a caller that I'm hoping we can squeeze in, but Justice Kagan asked, what if Texas could do better? They were very, you know, this is, you know, people have a right, adults have a right to watch porn and not have to give up all their private information, like their driver's license information. And so she said that there are ways to verify people's ID without having them give so much sensitive information. And what did you think about her dissent and some of the thoughts on, you know, not having such a high bar for verification on these sites?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not an internet privacy expert or internet technology expert, but I think she's got a point, right? The concern is that Texas will now have a database of people's IDs
who use
these sites. Mm-hmm. And maybe no one's really concerned about some sites, but hey, maybe Texas will be concerned about sites where LGBTQ sites, right? And now we have a list of our people in Texas who are adults who go to sites that have, say, gay sex. And now we want to target them for certain policies because it's certainly not a most favorable legislature with respect to LGBTQ issues. So those are the real privacy concerns here.
And people have.
I'm just curious, could this be extended out to just like social media in general? Like with all the conversation about the ill harm on teens for Snapchat, Instagram, etc. Say a law wanted to come down to say you have to prove your age to be able to use a site like that. Mm-hmm. Does this law kind of open the door for that?
Yeah, I think we're going to see that tested. Where, you know, there's been all sorts of different policy proposals in order to protect kids from predators on the internet or even just ads that are targeting them around eating disorders and those kinds of things. So maybe we'll have a state try to impose a similar age limit for something like that.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller. We have Trish from Newport, Delaware on the line. Trish, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment's on the birthright citizenship. And Pennsylvania is one of the few states in this area that isn't in on the lawsuit to allow people to have citizenship. And I just urge everybody with a conscience to please call the AG's office, email them, do whatever, send letters or whatever, because July 27th is when the door closes on people.
Yeah. Or the governor's office, because the governor can join the case too.
Yeah, thank you. That's Trish from Newport, Delaware. I also want to read these comments from Christine, who says, I think the ruling itself, and she's referring to that birthright citizenship universal injunction ruling, says, I think the ruling itself is neutral and even good if it stops one judge from making national law, but the constitutionality of birthright citizenship should have been found to be constitutionally correct. You know, we only have about a minute and a half left, but I want to just ask this question because I think about last term and I think about the court giving immunity to presidents. And it was a case that involved President Donald Trump. And I think about this ruling on birthright citizenship and universal injunctions. And I think when we go 20 years from now, when we look back to the last couple of terms, what do you think will be the major takeaway that sort of sticks with us for years to come?
I think what we're seeing is the Supreme Court giving extreme deference to Donald Trump. And history will tell us, in the history of the what's going to happen in the next 20 years, whether that was about Donald Trump and no one else, or was that really about the presidency and it will apply to other presidents? And I have concerns with either one of those, but certainly if this is really just about Donald Trump, that is the most concerning. If this is the Supreme Court saying Donald Trump is special, he gets immunity, we can't stop his executive orders, and then in the future, does not give immunity to other presidents, and does stop executive orders of other presidents, that's going to be very concerning.
Yeah, and as we've had this, I guess, whole debate over the past 10, 20 years about executive orders, I mean, really what this ruling does is kind of puts that on steroids, and it really retips the balance of power towards the executive.
Yeah, I mean, every president in the future now is going to come in and say, what can I do by executive order, even if it's not necessarily constitutional or legal for me to issue an executive order about this topic? Let me try, because who's going to stop me?
Yeah. And with that, we got to leave it there. Thank you so much. That is David Cohen, professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Thank you so much for being here on Studio 2 and helping us parse through all of this. We appreciate
it. It's hard, but thank you very much.
Yes. And I want to say thank you also to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Charlie Kyer, and Tina Calique, engineer today's show. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCorry, and for Avi Wolfman-Aaron, thank you for joining us.
See you tomorrow.